welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org. Today's program includes The War Over Climate with Eric Pooley and Eli Kintish from August 18, 2010. Francesca Viana talks with Eric Pooley about the politics of climate change. His book is The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. Also, Eli Kintish talks about geoengineering. His book is Hacking the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. This is 59 Minutes. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Andrew Basevich from August 9, 2010. Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He discusses the bipartisan business of war making, the destructive patriotism of Washington power elite, and why military power is useless at affecting positive social change. This is 9 minutes. And then after that, from Living on Earth, on October 1st, 2010, Yellow Dirt, Navajo country provided a significant share of America's Cold War uranium, but when the mining companies walked away, no one told the people not to build houses out of the material left behind. This is also 9 minutes.
Those who in the environmental community who have tried to get something done have tried to bring together those two ideas of the environment and economics. As you pointed out, the right has said it's too expensive to protect the environment. The left has said we can't take care of profits and protect the environment at the same time. We need to put the environment first. Tell us about the Environmental Defense Fund and the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. What's been their approach with environmental economics?
EDF and NRDC are the two mainstream groups who have really been inside the room trying to cut the deal with utilities, big companies, and the senators to try to get something done. They've taken some flack from environmental groups outside the room for being too ready to compromise with polluters. My own view is that we need all of these approaches. We need people outside the room arguing for more and better, and I have enormous respect for the groups like Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and others who are saying, we need to keep in mind that this is the future of our planet we're talking about, the habitability of the Earth and our stewardship of nature, and we can't just bargain it away. So that's an incredibly important point. I'm also mindful that the political system is the only vehicle we have for getting something done. So it's not like we can say, oh, compromise is such a mistake, let's go do this some other way. There is no other way. This is how we create change in America. So I also think the people inside the room trying to cut a deal are doing an important service, and you need them both, because you need the people outside the room to keep the folks inside the room honest and make sure that the deal is worth doing. So what is the deal? Well, the deal was, let's set a mandatory declining limit on carbon pollution, and let's give free allowances to some of the emitters to get them on board, and let's also let them use something called offsets, which are carbon credits for emissions reductions outside the system. They can do things like fund avoided deforestation in the tropical rainforests and other kinds of emissions reduction systems that can help us in the fight against carbon emissions, because the atmosphere doesn't care where these emissions reductions come from. They don't care if it's a coal-fired plant in Toledo or a rainforest that you don't burn down in Papua New Guinea. Any reductions are good for the planet. So offsets are another incredibly controversial part, because they're seen as letting polluters off the hook.
But they're also seen as being very subject to corruption and gaming the system.
Well, they are, and indeed there have been situations where they have been subject to corruption and to gaming. There's a set of offsets through something called the Clean Development Mechanism in the UN system, where China has taken a lot of money for projects that would have happened anyway. There are some horror stories there, But the good news is a lot of that has been cleaned up. And in fact, the CDM process just turned down a whole bunch of Chinese wind projects and didn't give them offset status through the CDM because they were going to be built anyway. They were so-called anyway tons. They would have happened, reductions that would have happened no matter what. So we've learned from our mistakes here, and I think we've cleaned up a lot of the excesses. Obviously, offsets need to be real, they need to be verifiable, and they need to be permanent. And if you can do that, I think they need to be part of the system, because they're a way to lure in not only the American polluters, but also other countries that don't need to be part of the global system, but it can bring them into play. So I don't think offsets ought to be thrown out, but I do think they ought to be strictly regulated. My preference would be by the EPA. So we're talking about all these things, offsets, carbon allowances, cap and trade. The fact is the Senate hasn't acted. It may be a couple of years or more before we get back to this debate in the United States Senate. Does that mean it's over? No, it doesn't mean it's over, because the EPA is moving ahead with regulation of stationary sources that may, for all we know, include some form of a cap and some form of trading to reduce costs. The EPA is going to unveil its policies in September, and they're due to take effect in January, and they'll be, or at least to begin rolling out in January. There will be lawsuits. There will be attempts to roll back EPA regulation in the Senate. There will be what Representative John Dingell described as a glorious mess of litigation and regulation. It's going to be lawsuits on the local level. Each power plant that EPA tries to regulate is going to be subject to litigation. There are going to be delays and confusion. It's going to take some time. Meanwhile, you've also got regional cap-and-trade systems that have been set up in the Northeast, in the West. About half the country by the end of 2012 will be under some form of a cap-and-trade regime for the electric sector. So we're moving ahead with this, even though the Senate isn't willing to act. And the hope is that we can do enough at the local, regional, and EPA level that we can keep this going until the Senate is ready to get going itself.
Eric Pooley on the climate war. Stay tuned for more after the break. But first, here's something to chew on. You think cutting carbon will be expensive? Well, here's the cost of continuing on the current path, $1,240 trillion. That's about 20% of global GDP. The cost of cutting emissions, somewhere between 2 and 3%. Of course, the longer we wait, the more expensive it'll be. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before the break, our guest Eric Pooley was talking about some end runs we might be able to do around the Senate's inaction on energy and the climate, like regional cap-and-trade systems or using the EPA to regulate emissions. But those can be held hostage to politics, too. You say that we have to deal with the political system that we have, and you've just talked about some of the regional initiatives that are there, but they also are subject to politics. Right now in California, as we do this interview, there's a move to take back a very innovative and forward, probably the best climate policy in the nation is being done in California, is going into effect in California, and there's a referendum to repeal it. And regionally, there can always be problems with, if you don't have a national policy, then you can play regions against each other. In other words, businesses can just elect to go elsewhere, let's say. So that brings us to another great part of a pressure point, and that is a social movement. Al Gore has been trying to develop that movement. You talk about that in your book, to use the media to build the political will. I'd like to start out this part by asking you to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to follow it up with kind of where are we going on that?
Well, I'd hate to think where we'd be in this battle without Al Gore. He gets criticized a lot. He's a lightning rod for partisan attacks. Because he had the guts to step up in 2006 with an inconvenient truth and tell everybody what was happening, and that was a galvanic moment in America. It was a moment when a lot of people began to take this issue seriously. Now, Gore had been talking about it for 20 years before that, and so had a lot of other people. But that was a turning point in American life, and Gore saw that he wasn't going to be able to do it himself and that he needed a movement to get this done, that America needed a movement, and that there was so much opposition and disinformation that we needed somebody to bring the tools of mass persuasion to bear on the side of the planet, because a lot of people were using PR and advertising on the side of the fossil fuel companies. So he wanted to even the playing field a bit, if you were, and he created the Alliance for Climate Protection to spend $300 million on state-of-the-art advertising over 3 years. And he thought that in that time we would pass a climate bill in the United States and then a global deal, that it was supposed to be a climate bill in the U.S. by 2009, so that we could take a great step forward in the Copenhagen summit in December of 2009 and take a first step toward a global deal. You know, the whole world, Francesca, has been waiting for the U.S. to get serious about this. And we can't get a global deal done until the U.S. actually passes an aggressive climate bill. It's just not going to happen until we take the first step, because we left the whole world hanging at Kyoto when everybody else signed on but us. That is, all the other developed countries. And we alone in the developed world have said we won't put that treaty into force. So, of course, it wasn't as effective without American leadership as it could have been. So we really need to step up on this issue. People say, well, what about China? What about India? Well, America has to go first. Without American leadership, we had a century-long head start over China and India toward American prosperity, the so-called American century. Because we benefited from that, we need to lead now. And we can't expect China to go at the same moment we do, or let alone go first. We have to go first. So that's been Al Gore's message. He's been trying to educate Americans about the climate threat, about the potential for a clean energy economy, about the urgency and solvability of this crisis, the fact that we need to get going now, but that we have the tools to do it. And he's done everything he knows how. He's, in my view, done a good job. People blame Al Gore and they say Al Gore has failed because we haven't passed a bill. I don't think it's about Gore, or I don't think it's fair to say Gore has failed. I think the failure is ours. I think Americans need to step up. This is not a spectator sport. You can't sit back in your chair and watch Al Gore and say, is he getting it done? We've got to get it done. We've got to step up. We've got to contact our politicians. And if we believe that a transition to a clean energy economy is going to be good for America, we have to let people know that. So I believe we live in a participatory democracy, and I think people need to make their voices heard. And certainly Gore has been frustrated that the movement has not taken off to the extent that he would like it to. He's still optimistic that it will. And frankly, there is no plan B. When you need to reduce industrial emissions, you got to reduce emissions. There's no other way around it. And as Gore told me in Copenhagen, the fact that this is hard to do doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. You know, we need to do this. People say, it's hard, let's do something else, let's wait for a silver bullet technology that's going to get this done for us. Well, you know, we don't believe in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy anymore, and we shouldn't believe that someone is going to come along and fix this problem for us. We have to fix it ourselves, and the way that we're going to accelerate the technology that we need is by putting a cap on carbon, or, God knows, putting a carbon tax in place. I'd be happy to do that, too.
I couldn't agree with you more about the need for Americans to step up. The one place where I have some doubts is about the participatory democracy, because poll after poll has shown, even latest polls have shown, that large majorities of the American people are in favor of climate policy that will really tackle the issue, and particularly if you can tell them that it's going to be good for the economy as well. And yet nothing is moving, and probably nothing is moving because there's such a lack of lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry on Congress. What do you think can break that lock?
Well, I think the people's voice can break that. And the fact is there is a majority in favor of climate action. It varies from the 55% to 75%, depending on the poll you look at and how the question is asked. But there is a majority. That said, if you ask people, what's the most important issue to you? Climate change won't even come up on the top 10. So it's not an issue that has a great deal of resonance with a lot of people. And people need to start talking about it more. The trouble is, it still seems abstract to a lot of people. You know, it's funny, but in the course of a long, hot summer, it pulls higher than it does in the winter. We are such reactive creatures that when it's 102 degrees in New York City, people start worrying about climate change. When it's 20 degrees in New York City, people don't worry about it as much. Let me tell you, it's as big a problem in the winter as it is in the summer, because our winter is someone else's summer, and what's happening is happening globally. That's why they call it global climate change. We need to get over this fact that whether we happen to have a hot day or a cold day has any bearing on what's happening long term to our climate. And we need to wake up and smell the coffee about what the effects are going to be. There's a new book out by Heidi Cullen called The Weather of the Future, which talks about how the weather is going to be changing as the climate changes just over the next 20, 30 years. We're not talking about something that's going to be happening in the distant future anymore. The change is upon us. And the trouble is, we can't wait until we experience all those changes. Then it's going to be too late. We need to get going now. So there are people that think we can't afford to wait until there's a popular movement. The trouble is that if you look at American history, the transformative legislation that has passed the Senate and the Congress tends to be aided and abetted by the voice of Americans. The civil rights legislation, even health care last year and early this year. When people speak up, things begin to change, and people need to speak up on this issue.
Eric Pooley, your terrific book will help Americans do that. It's called The Climate War: True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. Thanks so much.
Francesca, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was a good conversation.
You can read Eric Pooley's blog post on the Senate's failure to pass the climate bill by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to a report from the Presidential Climate Action Project on what Obama could do right now to tackle the climate crisis without Congress. And next up, Hacking the Planet. We talk with Eli Kintish about some extreme measures against climate change. Researchers in Europe have just come out with a new climate change model that says the tipping point for runaway climate change is a whole lot closer than we thought. 2015, a mere 5 years from now. If we don't start cutting global carbon emissions by then, we're toast. Literally. Or are we? Is there another approach? One that can buy us time? It's the engineering that dare not speak its name. Geoengineering. That's what science reporter Eli Kintish writes about in his book, Hack the Planet. It's controversial. For one, when you start messing around with Mother Nature, there could be some serious unexpected blowback, like cutting off so much light from the sun, crops can't grow. On the other hand, what we're doing to the climate may force us to consider geoengineering just to buy us time. Eli Kintish, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks, Francesca. Glad to be here.
Now, in Hack the Planet, which is about the geoengineering of the planet to avert climate catastrophe, you say that it's the engineering that dare not speak its name. Why is that?
For a number of years, Francesca, the idea of actually using climate science to imagine changing the planet's temperature or climate directly was a kind of rogue concept, and scientists who talked about it did it among themselves, and they weren't really accepted at the major meetings or journals for climate science. And the reason, I think, is that the powers that be with among climate scientists know that while we understand the big questions about climate, that the planet is warming and that human activity is largely responsible and that the risks of that could be incredible, we don't know the answers to the small questions, the role of aerosols in the atmosphere, for example, or where all of the carbon goes after it's emitted. And so the idea of actually coming up with deliberate means of controlling the atmosphere is, to most scientists, kind of a disturbing concept, given those uncertainties. But that's changed in the last 3 years because scientists have come to worry that even if we were to pass our most aggressive greenhouse gas cuts, which, by the way, is a bit of a stretch, we may still see some pretty bad scenarios for the warming planet, and that some very responsible scientists have thought that we might need an alternative strategy. Or at least a parallel strategy.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary. Was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, and snow crested brown, without no sleep or night or work. She'll be a true love of sweet time. I'm aware of the cloudy and calm. Tell her to find me an acre of land, a sprinkling of leaves, parsley, sage, rosemary, and blossoms that are with summer and tears between the salt water and sunsy strands. She's a gun. She'll be a true love of mine. Tell her to reap it in a sickle bill, blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and girls born in the soldiers to kill. And
from great speeches and interviews after these messages.